From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. As soon as next year, the University of California might drop its requirement applicants take the SAT or ACT. A few other elite schools have done it, seemingly without problem. However, admissions test supporters say some standardized tests should be required. Otherwise, they warn of serious unintended consequences. We'll get into it right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be with you today. My thanks to Libby Denkman for hosting in my absence yesterday. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about Asian American groups challenging Harvard's admission policy as racially discriminatory. Yesterday, those groups suffered a setback in court, but many legal analysts think the matter is far from settled. We'll look at the court road ahead. But first, another college admissions controversy. The LA Times' Teresa Watanabe reports some University of California regents are anxious to drop the requirement for SAT or ACT test scores. They argue the tests discriminate against lower-income students of non-college-educated parents. If UC drops the requirement, it could have a big effect on the admissions requirements of other elite schools. Let's get into the pros and cons of it on Air Talk today. We begin with Robert Schaefer, who's public education director at the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. Mr. Schaefer, thank you so much for joining us. A lot of schools are looking at the standardized admissions tests, concerned that they are economically and racially discriminatory. What are the studies of the test show?
Well, thank you, Larry, for having Fair Test on your show today. More than 1,050 colleges and universities in the U.S., about 40% of all undergraduate institutions, now are test optional. They've decided, based on the data, their own internal research and independent studies, that the SAT is not necessary to do high-quality, fair admissions. In fact, requiring the ACT and SAT undermines goals of equity and doesn't help improve student academic quality. The studies of the schools that have gone test optional, and this includes large, highly selective schools like the University of Chicago, public university systems in a number of states, and many small liberal arts colleges like Pitzer in the Los Angeles area, have shown that going test optional increases the quality of applicants in terms of high school preparation, increases the diversity of the applicant pool, and does not in any way negatively impact the performance of the students you admit.
How do you then peg a student who goes to a school, let's say, as an all-A student at a weak high school? They really haven't been exposed to the kind of rigor and the subject, tougher subject material that students at another school might go to. How do you sort of peg the ability of that student to catch up at an elite school?
Well, studies by the test makers themselves show that high school GPA, despite all the weaknesses in that as an objective, consistent measure, predicts undergraduate performance better than the SAT or ACT does. So it shows how poor the tests are as predictors. But experienced, knowledgeable admissions officers at colleges can make those kinds of judgments about the quality of preparation. Grades alone, when added to things like rigor of undergraduate, of high school preparation, whether a student has taken the most challenging courses available to her, turns out to be a far stronger predictor of graduation and the things that matter in college and life than simply filling in bubbles for 3 hours on a Saturday morning standardized exam.
We're talking with our guest, Bob Schaefer, joining us, Public Education Director at the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. I welcome your calls, your thoughts about this at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Mr. Schaefer, also, what about the concerns that, yeah, this works for the few schools that do it now, because high schools haven't taken note of it? If all the elite schools made the admissions tests optional, that you'd have such pressure for grade inflation that, you know, essentially any competent student would end up with all A's.
Well, in fact, many of the elite schools have already made the SAT and ACT optional. Right now, more than half of the top 100 liberal arts colleges in the nation are test optional. So that, and that hasn't, the kind of negative effects that you're talking about simply have not happened. In Texas, for example, where if you're in the top 10% of your high school class, your test scores do not matter in the admissions process to the University of Texas system, there hasn't been grade inflation or manipulation. It's a fantasy that, that something like that will take place. And it's an argument made by defenders of the testing industry, which now takes in billions of dollars a year for unnecessary exams.
Also joining us is immediate past chair and member of the currently member of the UC Board of Regents, George Kiefer. Mr. Kiefer, thank you for being with us. What do you see as the drawbacks of making the tests optional?
Well, let me first say that from my point of view, the Regents, actually through the president's direction and request to the Academic Senate, asked the Academic Senate of the University of California to do a very thorough review of all of the studies that have been done in this area, sort of reanalyze the studies as well as their own analysis. And the Academic Senate will be reporting to the board sometime in the spring, I suspect, the spring or mid-year, with a recommendation of whether to continue with the SAT and ACT tests as mandatory, we'll make them optional, or completely remove them, or something else. And for me, that's what I'm waiting for. There is a movement, certainly, and has been going on for a long time, to make the tests optional or remove them completely. There have been defenders with the with ACT and with the SAT organizations, and then there have been those who have argued for maintaining some kind of test that is comparative across the board. The concern that I raised the other day at the Board of Regents meeting, which was not on the agenda, we just got into a kind of an ad hoc discussion about it, was whether the state will always need, and the country actually, we'll always need some kind of standardized test to weigh how we're doing overall and how our high schools are doing against each other on these kinds of tests. And there are plenty of tests out there that might be used besides the SAT. So I know there are firm advocates of dropping or making it optional, like Mr. Schaefer, but I want to see what our own faculty say. Now, in the end, the Board of Regents will make the decision based on the faculty representation, recommendation to us. The things I worry about are the ones that were raised, because there has been great inflation over the last few years, and I do worry sort of a race to inflated grades if that's what we're looking at, and also distinctions between high schools and other schools as to how they do grade as between each other. Test scores were used in the 1920s to break down barriers to have more access to higher education. As Eloy on our board, who was another one of your guests, has pointed out, in the 50s, they were used in Texas to prevent access. I think you have to separate what your goal is. Is your goal a certain purpose goal of increasing access alone or limiting access? Or is your goal some way to determine merit, which is very, very iffy, kind of a questionable goal always? So to me, these are tough questions. They're not easy questions, and I certainly was not in favor of having the board operate, and I don't think any of our regents are in favor either. operate without the input of the Academic Senate, which is what I'm looking for.
George Kiefer with us, who is a member of the UC Board of Regents. Also with us, was just mentioned, Eloy Ortiz Oakley, who is a member of the UC Board of Regents. He's also the Chancellor of California's Community Colleges. Mr. Oakley, thank you for being with us. What would you see that would take the place of the ACT or SAT?
Well, first of all, thank you, Larry, for having me on the show, and thank you for discussing this topic. First of all, I would say that in my personal experience, and as well as my experience with the California Community Colleges, I wouldn't favor any standardized test. So the notion of having to replace it, I think, is the wrong question. I don't think we replace one bad test with another bad test. I think there is a lot of data available to make decisions on admissions that are much better predictors of a student's ability to succeed in college. And so I don't see the need for another test. I think certainly in the California Community Colleges, we have done away with standardized testing with the recent passage and implementation of Assembly Bill 705. In just the first few semesters, we've seen a huge increase in the number of low-income and students of color taking and succeeding in transfer-level math and English courses. So for us, we think that using a multiple measures approach, taking information that already exists from a student's background and experience, is all we need to best predict students' abilities.
How, and maybe you don't think this is even important to know, but how do you determine a prospective student's knowledge base? Because the tests tell you, at least in that sort of artificial environment, what a student, through their own preparation to take the test, what they were able to share of their knowledge. Grades aren't necessarily a proxy for that. So what is the thing that, and maybe you think knowledge isn't really the issue because the student can be a comparative tabula rasa when they come to a four-year school and you take them from there. But is there some other way of getting to knowledge?
Sure, yes. I think certainly this is a fundamental question. And I guess the first thing I would say is right now the SAT is not being used to measure knowledge. It is being used to sort who gets in to a university. So I think at this point, the question of whether you're talking about concerns about grade inflation or anything else, I think the issue is, given a student's experience in high school, there is a lot of information that can be gained from that. What we do know is that SAT scores or ACT scores are a much better predictor of a student's wealth, their family wealth, than knowledge. So while I agree that we need to continue to search for more and better ways to gain information about a student's college preparedness, what we're using today we know is not a predictor of knowledge. It is a predictor of how much wealth a family has, how much they can invest in test prep, how much they can invest in buying their way into a university, not on whether a student is knowledgeable. And I think this is particularly a problem for low-income students who we continue to put in a situation where they're competing against peers who have much greater access to resources.
Well, now there's Khan Academy, which is free, though. My son used that for his SAT prep, and he found it extremely helpful. We didn't pay for any prep. He did very well on the test. Khan Academy is available to anyone who can get on Wi-Fi. Has that not helped to level the playing field?
Certainly, you can look at several things that are helpful to try and level the playing field. But as long as the playing field is driven by access to resources, then you're never going to level the playing field. Second thing I'd say is we still have the problem that studies continue to show that the SAT is not a good predictor of college success. So why do we continue to invest in it? And I would argue that we continue to invest in it because it has become part of the infrastructure of admissions. It has become a sorting mechanism, not a mechanism to determine whether a student is able to succeed in college.
We're talking with the Chancellor of California's Community Colleges, a member of the UC Board of Regents, Eloy Ortiz Oakley, also with us, UC Board of Regents member George Kiefer, who's the immediate past chair of the board. Mr. Kiefer, your response to the points that your colleague just made.
I think they're all good points, but I don't think they necessarily take in the whole picture. And I think you're always going to want, I think the state will want a some kind of a comparator of between high schools and between students. And in the end, though, if the report comes back from our academic senate and goes deep dives into all these areas, and they are comfortable that it's not necessary for all these reasons, then I assume we may drop the SAT or the ACT tests. But I think that the notion that you have no test, that we throw out any kind of bases for comparison, is a long-term mistake, not only for California, University of California, but for the state and the nation.
So first of all, does knowledge entering college matter? And if it does, then is there any other way than a standardized test to measure knowledge?
Well, I think they've tried to improve these tests over the years. With how much better they've gotten, I think it's debatable. I think there's a sense that they are certainly less biased in terms of the language that are used, words that are used. So I think some of that's been hit. It's interesting, I think, that whether we're right or we're wrong, we're going in the opposite direction of a lot of the world in this. And I think the bottom line, as long as that access is not entirely open, in other words, as long as there are only so many spots in colleges, then you're going to be making decisions about who gets in and who doesn't get in. And whether you call it, everybody may be very capable of benefiting from higher education. And in fact, we're encouraging that now. But we're out of whack with that philosophy of that everybody can benefit when we only have so many spaces available. And when you have only so many spaces available, you get down to some kind of question of merit. Now, grades alone may be that way. On the other hand, the notion of having some standardized tests, and because the ones we have now have been biased, and doesn't mean that they can't be made less biased, and there isn't some solution. So I'm not prepared to give up on that hope. But in the end, if that's what the decision of our academic senate is, I'm going to be inclined to go that way. I do think over the long term that there are some risks that you have to look at, and I think that it's not a false risk that grade inflation will continue.
Okay.
Drive things.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. That's George Kiefer, UC Board of Regents, Eloy Ortiz Oakley, also UC Board of Regents and Chancellor of California's Community Colleges, and Bob Schaefer of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. You can share your comments about the SAT and ACT, should they be required for applicants for the University of California. Laren in Cypress says, I think the test's unnecessary. I have a senior freshman in college. She doesn't think that they do a very good job of measuring aptitude for college. Jerry in Redondo Beach said, I wouldn't have been able to get into a good college on grades alone. It was my SAT scores that made me stand out. I'm for keeping the test. You can share your comments again. AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have another college admissions issue to take up next, and that involves some Asian American parents groups who've sued Harvard University alleging racial discrimination. We'll be back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Jonathan Mooney, author of Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. But right now, college admissions continues as our focus with yesterday's federal court decision that went against the group of Asian American parents who sued Harvard University, alleging racial discrimination. The case, one that's being closely watched and thought potentially fodder for the U.S. Supreme Court to take it up. The group that are the plaintiffs in the case are called Students for Fair Admissions, and they accused Harvard of deliberately and illegally suppressing the number of Asian Americans accepted in order to preserve a predetermined racial balance on campus. U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs, who's President Obama nominee, ruled that Harvard's admissions process isn't perfect but passes constitutional muster. With us is Loyola Law School Professor Kim West Falcon, who's going to share with us her thoughts on this. Professor, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it. What to you stands out in the judge's written decision here?
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. What stands out is the fact that the judge seemed to have recognized that what posed the potential threat of discrimination against Asian Americans were policies that were white advantaging policies. Like she used several times a reference to ALDCs, athletes, legacies, dean's list, and the children of faculty and staff, and pointed out that 30% of those admitted to Harvard come from that group, which makes up a pretty small percentage of the applicant pool. So in the big picture, the judge didn't fall prey to what is a common trap of thinking that race-based affirmative action is what could cause an Asian penalty. So in that sense, she seemed to distinguish between the two ideas. On the first, she seemed to take quite seriously the claims that Asian Americans could be the victims of discrimination in Harvard's policy, but went through very methodically and concluded that the plaintiff's organizational plaintiff, which is also led by an individual, Ed Blum, who has litigated many anti-affirmative action cases and gone to the Supreme Court multiple times, including also the Voting Rights Act case. So there's a broader context to this in addition to those who are concerned about Asian American discrimination. So she concluded that the facts just weren't there, that Harvard wasn't operating a quota system and it wasn't engaged in racial balancing, and that therefore they were using race for the other purpose, the race-based affirmative action purpose, in a way that satisfied the legal standard under Title VI.
We're talking with Loyola Law Professor Kim West Falcon. We invite your calls if you have a perspective you want to share about this case, which yesterday in federal court, Massachusetts, Judge Allison Burroughs ruled that Harvard's admissions process, though flawed, does not racially discriminate. Also with us is Wen Fa, attorney with the Libertarian-Minded Pacific Legal Foundation based here in California. Mr. Fa, thank you for joining us. What do you think the judge got wrong here?
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that in this case, there's no dispute. Harvard actually acknowledges that it considers race as a factor in the admissions process. So anytime a university considers race, it has to show under Supreme Court case law that its use of race is narrowly tailored toward a compelling interest. Both those factors have to be met. And, you know, I think in this case, I would say that neither of those factors have been met. As to the compelling interest, the Supreme Court has said very clearly that diversity has to be the broad type of diversity that encompasses many factors besides race. But the district court only discussed this in a couple of paragraphs in a 130-page opinion, so it didn't really adequately say why, how the use of race addressed that type of broad-based diversity. In terms of narrow tailoring, the Supreme Court has only endorsed the use of race as a last resort, and there are plenty of race-neutral alternatives, such as the preference for alumni and relatives of faculty members that the professor mentioned, that I think the court really failed to adequately consider as as alternatives that Harvard should use before it used race in its admissions.
What's the next legal step here? We assume the plaintiffs will appeal this. Where would it go?
Well, it would go to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Massachusetts. I suspect that the plaintiffs will appeal in this case. And, you know, the district court's opinion, although it was unfavorable, it was very thorough and addressed the merits, which is good because in some of these cases you have, for example, issues about standing and other more technical things rather than the merits. But here the court engaged with the arguments on the merits. We just ultimately think that it reached the wrong decision, the wrong conclusion with respect to the compelling interest and the narrow tailoring.
Professor West Falcon, do you think this is almost certainly going to the Supreme Court?
Well, I definitely think that the goal of, again, Ed Blum in bringing the case and facilitating the founding of the SFA organization is to get cases of this nature to the Supreme Court. He has said as much in multiple media interviews, and he's succeeded before. His one of his early forays into this made it to the Supreme Court twice. It was a lawsuit against the University of Texas at Austin on behalf of that case, unlike this case, had an actual named plaintiff, Abigail Fisher. And so there are two Supreme Court cases, Fisher 1 and Fisher 2. So the combination of having the resources, finding the attorneys, and also continuing to set up a topic where you have several justices on the Supreme Court who have a longstanding opposition to even the most narrowly tailored consideration of race in selective higher education admissions means that these cases are ripe for the Supreme Court considering them. These are justices who have consistently been on the losing side, so there's well-settled precedent that Harvard is behaving legally and that if you use race only as a plus factor, I would respectfully disagree with respect to how broadly Harvard defines diversity. The judge did go into great lengths about how multidimensional was a key aspect of being admitted to Harvard, and Harvard's admissions policy was actually added as an appendix to the very first affirmative action case in this realm back in the 70s, the Bakke case. So it's the quintessential example of considering diversity in all its diverse forms. But I definitely think that whether it's this case or the case that the same individual and organization, Ed Blum, has filed against the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the intent is to appeal and appeal and appeal so that the Supreme Court will have multiple opportunities to take this issue up. And his long-term agenda, he's been very explicit about, is to have those other cases overturned, to have a different law.
Professor, one thing I was curious about, and you just mentioned it there, the plus factor for underrepresented groups. What does that mean? Because I think if there's something additive in the individual's application because of the person's racial ethnic identity, isn't that effectively a disadvantage to those who can't use that as a plus factor?
Well, and that's the very intuitive way that most of us think about it because we're not immersed in the actual details of how Harvard uses race. And so because Harvard, like many universities and the admissions officers, are themselves real experts on all of these cases that have gone to the Supreme Court, they have, over the decades, used race quite differently. With each ruling from the Supreme Court, they've been advised that they can't use race in a way that's explicit racial balancing, that they can't give a certain number of points to race. And so the judge, again, in this very detailed ruling, lays out the different kinds of ratings that Harvard uses. And so they go through and assign about five different kinds of ratings, an academic rating, a personal rating, and an athletic rating, and an extracurricular rating, and they're not permitted and they do not consider race in those ratings. And then race can be potentially a plus factor at the final overall rating stage. But what the judge did a very good job of pointing out is that these other factors, based on what the expert said, athletics is a weighted more, and that these legacy and dean's list, that to the extent there's a potential plus, it's not higher for race. But again, the court has permitted some consideration of race. You just can't do it in a numerical fashion.
We're talking with Loyola Law Professor Kim West Falcon, who focuses on anti-discrimination and constitutional law, among other specialties. Also with us, attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, Wen Fa. Mr. Fa, you want to respond to what the professor was just saying about how, in her view, the judge spelled this out very clearly?
Well, I think your intuition was right when you mentioned that when race is used as a plus factor for some, that necessarily means that it's used as a minus factor for others. And the things that the professor was talking about with respect to personal scores, that was one thing that came out in the litigation, which was, you know, at least in the past, Harvard had been assigning, the admissions office at Harvard had been assigning a lower personal score for Asian Americans, even though the other things that the professor was talking about, things like alumni interviews, Asians did just as well on those interviews. So I think Harvard is using race in its admissions policy. It admits as much. And I think that's one of the things that affects so many people around the United States. You know, you have Asians who are seeking admissions to these universities. They are being told in test prep programs that they shouldn't say they want to be doctors. They shouldn't want to say they want to major in mathematics or the sciences because they would be seen as a standard Asian. And that's just very hurtful to people. Everybody should be able to pursue his or her own dreams, regardless of race. And I think ultimately that's what this lawsuit is about.
Well, that's such an odd thought that the student tries to disguise him or herself as an aspiring poet instead of physician to get an advantage in getting into college, if that's the case. From the Pacific Legal Foundation, libertarian public interest law organization, Wen Fa, also Kim West Falcon, who's law professor at Loyola Law School. You can share your thoughts about the first round of this legal battle on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming right up, we'll talk with Jonathan Mooney, author of the new book, Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to have a fun segment where we talk about recreating classics at long-gone restaurants, whether it's a baked good, an entree that you've tried to resurrect in the home kitchen, guessing as to the proper proportions in the recipe. We'll talk about that coming up next hour. But right now, we talk about the concept of normal. Jonathan Mooney's new book is Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. This along the lines of the conversation we had about neurodiversity last week on Air Talk. Jonathan, good to have you with us today. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. Big fan.
Well, I appreciate it. Growing up, you write in this book about your experience as a kid who was diagnosed with certain learning disabilities. How did it affect you and your parents to get that diagnosis?
Well, I mean, before the diagnosis, I had the very subtle labels of being the stupid, crazy, lazy kid. And I spent a lot of the day chilling out with the janitor in the hallway, grew up on a first-name basis with Shirley, the receptionist in the principal's office. Spent a lot of the day hiding in the bathroom to escape reading out loud with tears streaming down my face. So the diagnosis was a story of one step forward, one step back. It was a step forward because it's better to be dyslexic or ADD than it is to be the stupid, crazy, lazy kid.
Well, and you have some sense of understanding what's going on neurologically.
You have some sense of understanding and you have some sense of destigmatization, right? It's not a moralization of a kid. But it's one step backwards because inherent in those diagnoses is the notion of deficit, disorder, a pathologizing of a kid. I mean, I remember when I got the test results, and me and my mom went into the school psychologist's office. And the moment we walked into that office, it was obvious everyone thought we were getting terrible news. You know, the lights were down low. There was jazz music playing in the background. There was a box of tissues on the table. You know, it was like we were there to mourn the death of my normality. So it's better to be dyslexic than stupid, that's for sure.
Or lazy, yeah.
Or lazy.
Which has a moral judgment.
Moral judgment to it. But ultimately, I was made to feel that my differences were deficiencies, and that's what took me a long time to heal from.
What would have been a better approach? Because we could think of the value of you learning that information about yourself. What would have been messaging about that which would have helped you feel good about yourself, but understanding the challenges that that diagnosis realistically brings?
Yeah, you know, fast forward a couple years from that scene in the school psychologist's office, and we do have the better approach. It's a teacher I had grown up named Mr. R. I grew up here in the South Bay in Manhattan Beach, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this man. And he was a man that had a relentless commitment to the idea that everyone had something right with him. And he pulled my mom and I aside one day and said, "Hey, congratulations, Jonathan's dyslexic." What a different scene than the tissues on the table. And he went off to talk about all of the strengths and talents that come with having a diverse learning style, not despite the challenges, but because of them. And that's an opportunity that every psychologist, every teacher has. You know, the story of neurodiversity is a complex story. It's a story of a very specific neurobiologically based challenges, which are real, but it's also a story of very specific neurobiologically based strengths and gifts that go hand in hand. So what I advocate for, what would have been better in my life, is let's tell the whole story. Let's talk about the challenges. Let's talk about the strengths, gifts, and talents as well.
We're talking with Jonathan Mooney, author of Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. If you're a fan of his writing, his previous books, or the new one, we welcome you joining us at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I think this applies even beyond something that's neurologically or educationally diagnosable, because all of our kids and we ourselves have certain aspects about us that are challenges, that are things where we don't feel that we fit in, where we lag behind others, that, you know, are difficult for us, and other things where we might have some sort of an advantage compared to others in the world. That's sort of, you know, that's sort of the typical thing. And so part of our jobs, I would argue, as parents or working in education, whatever, is to help the young people that we work with or in our families to see this more, you know, sort of as a holistic thing. And that much of life and being a successful person, whatever that means, is sort of managing yourself and dealing with all the, you know, with the different challenges and strengths that we have, and just seeing ourselves as straightforwardly as we can.
Much of life is extricating ourselves from the imperative to be normal, regardless of who we are. You know, a philosopher I admire named Michel Foucault wrote that we live in the normalizing society, and the judges of normality are ever present everywhere. And it is a concept that looms over all of us. It looms over those of us who are called not normal because of specific learning, attentional, atypical brains or bodies. But it looms over even those of us who think we are normal or try to capitulate to the idea of normal. The reality is the only normal people are people you don't know very well. The moment you get to know another human being, it's their eccentricities, their fallibility, their strengths, their talents, their disabilities, their abilities that constitute their humanity. So it's a more authentic, it's a more human way to live, to embrace that reality of difference.
The challenge is, of course, that, and let's take ADHD for an example, is that so many jobs as schools today reward the ability to attend over a given period of time. So how do you, in a world that's largely structured for people who can focus for an extended period, and schools reward that, and the workplace generally, not exclusively, but generally reward, then how do you deal with that wiring?
Well, you know, first, I think at the highest level, we should be challenging the school environments and work environments that are only built for certain types of minds and brains. You know, we just had a vibrant conversation around the issue of diversity in your previous segment in a different context. But what we're talking about here, what I'm talking about and advocating for, is the idea of reframing states of being that have historically been pathologized, seen through the lens of sickness, deficit, and disorder, as manifestations of human diversity. And just like we have a moral and ethical imperative to build school environments that don't just work for some kids, but work for all kids when it comes to the issue of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, we also have a moral imperative to build school environments and work environments that embrace those cognitive differences and celebrates them as well.
This reminds me, and I've shared this on the air before, when I was in sixth grade in elementary school in Inglewood, I was in an experimental classroom where the teacher didn't do the conventional get up in front of the class and teach. And everything was set up around stations in the classroom, and you could decide what you wanted to study at a given point. And then there was self-assessment. You could help other students who were – and the teacher's available for you to come. So the students who had a difficult time focusing on one thing for an extended period could work a little bit on math. Then they could work on history. Then they could work, and the teachers available to help them where they got stuck. So they didn't have to keep up with sort of, here's the state of the classroom, and you've got to be like everybody else. But it enabled a kind of individualization of education. And it just doesn't – I'm not aware of a lot of experimentation like that these days.
Well, it's a perfect example of how environments, the environments we set up, work, home, school, can enable – or disable. But too often we call the person who doesn't fit the environment the problem. But the reality is that in my life, ADD wasn't the problem. You know, the school desk was the problem. The idea that you had to sit still all day long as a way to learn, that was the problem. And ultimately, the social shame or stigma of not being able to fit, that really was the problem. You know, people don't have disability. They experience disability in environments that don't embrace difference.
We'll continue with Jonathan Mooney, his new book, Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Line. We're at 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Jonathan Mooney. He's an author, public speaker, and speaking of which, he'll be talking about his book, Normal Sucks, at the Friendship Foundation tonight in Redondo Beach. The South Bay is his home region. The event starts at 7 o'clock tonight, and we have information you can link to our AirTalk page at kpecc.org. If you're someone who is not what we call typical, you're someone who's different in some way, and that's presented a challenge. What helped you be able to work around that? Or, was it Mr. R, your teacher, who did that for you when you were in school, Jonathan? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Angela writes on the page, I've never fit in. What I've learned in my adulthood is to be completely comfortable in my own skin. And much to my surprise, people are drawn to that. The teenage me, who suffered greatly because I could not and would not conform, never saw this love of self coming. Angela, thanks so much for sharing that. JSK writes, poor memory required me to process and create a cognitive map of understanding something to be able to recall it, though in an altered form. And I was just sharing with you during the break about a family member who has dyslexia, who runs his own mortgage company, dealing with numbers all day long. Because he was so smart, he was able to find his own workarounds to be able to be dyslexic and be able to do that kind of work. So we're asking you, what if you're in that category, what have been your workarounds? Who was the person who inspired you? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jonathan, what kind of progress do you see in the ways that we're talking about people who are not neurotypical these days?
Well, I think your comments from your listeners are an example of that progress. The acceptance of self and also the recognition that there are value, strengths, and talents, not despite the difference, but because of it. That sounds like a subtle distinction, despite versus because, but it's not. You know, for most of human history, we have said that folks with atypical brains and bodies have problems that they overcome. They overcome their problems. And if they contribute to the world, it's despite their differences. But we are now in a moment where research, brain science, has shown us that there are strengths and talents that are intrinsically linked to these differences. We know more than ever that while people with dyslexia struggle with reading and writing, that there are gifts that come with that. I'm that way, you know. I read in the 12th percentile. I spell at a third grade level. When I went to college, I thought that the university offered a course in orgasmic chemistry, right?
That might be an interesting offer.
Well, imagine my disappointment on the first day of that class.
For that class, yeah.
But what goes hand in hand with the challenges of reading are creativity, entrepreneurship, and problem solving. So that is progress for us to recognize that in the scientific community and beyond.
Pete in Burbank, thank you for joining us. So what were you able to be able to leverage it with your learning disability?
I performed over 8,000 stand-up shows around the country, headlining the Hard Rocks and comedy clubs. And yeah, I struggled, you know, 4 hours a day in an LD program. And then the second 4 hours a day, I would go to vocational electronics and fix TVs, and nobody ever seemed to notice that. But what I find interesting is I talk about the learning disability program in my show, which for the most part gets great laughs. And then once in a while, you'll get someone who's offended over making fun of yourself, which I find kind of ironic.
That is kind of ironic, because you would think people would see that sort of, you know, recognition of aspects of themselves or people they know. And obviously you're doing stand up in front of crowds, so it's not like you're bemoaning you're a loser.
Well, I think, as we know, people don't get upset about what you say. They get upset about the story they make up about what you say, but they don't really understand that.
What did you have to at some point realize you had this ability, or did you have the confidence that you could be a performer even at a young age, even as you struggled in the classroom?
I think the reason I went into it was because I was desperately looking for some sort of validation, and I knew that I could make an impact with people with my humor, which is kind of interesting, because if you're always looking for validation, that doesn't serve you in the long run. And eventually I turned the validation into being a contribution. And that made a huge difference for me later down the road.
Pete, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. You mind sharing your last name? We'll look for you on stage.
Yeah, it's Pete George, and I go by the rock star of comedy because I use an electric guitar in half my show as well.
All right, sounds fun. Pete in Burbank joining us, 866-893-KPECC. Sparky in Santa Monica says, I have ADHD, and teachers didn't know what to do with me. I eventually got held back in high school, and I have to agree with Jonathan that normal sucks. 866-893-KPECC. Paul in North Hill says, I was diagnosed with as dyslexic when I was seven. At the time, the term was relatively unknown, and it affected my academics, led me to drop out when I was in high school. Jonathan, just real briefly, do you feel like there are some schools that are starting to figure this out, diversify the way that they educate kids who are different?
Yeah, there's Mr. R's all around the country. There's people who see the potential of the Pete's of the world. There's schools committed to a broader definition of diversity here in Los Angeles and beyond. And I'm inspired by that future and inspired by everyone who had the courage here to share their different and to challenge the idea that there's one way to be.
Jonathan Mooney, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. Once again, it'll be in the South Bay tonight at 7 o'clock, Redondo Beach at the Friendship Foundation. We have a link on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We have a lot more to talk about in the second hour, and I'll tell you about it momentarily. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We've got a very busy hour Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk about potentially expanding sales tax to services, not just goods in California. The idea would be it would give a more stable base to tax collections in the state, which are highly volatile now, makes it difficult to do longer-term budgeting. But there are trade-offs, and we'll talk about those. Meanwhile, we're just learning the Los Angeles Times reporting that in a statement provided to it by the Los Angeles Opera, that Placido Domingo is stepping down as the general director of the opera company and also withdrawing from future performances. The Times, quoting the statement provided to them, is reading, "Recent accusations that have been made against me in the press have created an atmosphere in which my ability to serve this company that I so love has been compromised. While I will continue to work to clear my name, I've decided that it is in the best interest of LA Opera for me to resign as its general director and withdraw from my future scheduled performances at this time. I do so with a heavy heart and at the same time wish to convey to the company's dedicated board and hardworking staff my deepest wishes that the LA Opera continue to grow and excel." Now, the Times quotes LA Opera as responding by thanking Domingo, calling him the driving force behind the creation and growth of LA Opera, and crediting him for cultural contributions to the city that are unprecedented and profound. So this, again, coming in the midst of an independent investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by Placido Domingo, a law firm hired by LA Opera, looking into that, as is the union that represents opera performers. They're also conducting their own investigation. We move on to talk about the very latest in the impeachment inquiry by the House of Representatives, multiple committees that are taking place. As I mentioned at the outset of the hour, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, in a letter that he sent yesterday to the House of Representatives, says that he is not going to be making available senior officials in the State Department to be deposed by the House Intelligence Committee. Then this morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff held a joint news conference, and Adam Schiff made an interesting statement about how they're going to interpret the refusal of the administration to comply with requests to appear.
We are deeply concerned about Secretary Pompeo's effort now to potentially interfere with witnesses whose testimony is needed before our committee, many of whom are mentioned in the whistleblower complaint. And we want to make it abundantly clear that any effort by the secretary, by the president, or anyone else to interfere with the Congress's ability to call before it relevant witnesses will be considered as evidence of obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress.
That's Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. President Trump, this morning before his meeting with the president of Finland, had this to say about the impeachment inquiry.
Well, the whistleblower was very inaccurate. The whistleblower started this whole thing by writing a report on the conversation I had with the president of Ukraine. And the conversation was perfect. It couldn't have been nicer. I saw Rick Scott. I saw many of the senators talking about it, many of the congressmen talking about it. Not a thing wrong. Unless you heard the Adam Schiff version where he made up my conversation. He actually made it up. It should be criminal. It should be treasonous. He made it up. Every word of it made up and read to Congress as though I said it.
And what he's referring to there was the caricature of the Trump conversation with the president of Ukraine. And that sort of parody or caricature has itself been criticized, even by some Democrats who've said that was not the best move for Chairman Schiff to do in setting up the impeachment inquiry and the work of the Intelligence Committee. With us to talk about the latest in the toe-to-toe battle between the branches of government, White House correspondent for Politico, a Anita Kumar. Anita, thanks for joining us again. Obviously, the rhetoric is getting even more heated here. What's been the response in the 90 minutes or so since Adam Schiff's statement that a refusal to comply with a request to appear for the committee will be considered itself evidence of the veracity of the underlying complaint?
Well, you just see that the administration and the president himself are really pushing back on that, and they're just pushing back on, you know, having to go and explain themselves. The president is about to actually have a news conference alongside the leader of Finland, and so I'm sure he's going to be asked about that. But, you know, he had some very strong words just talking to reporters a little while ago about, you know, he continues to say the same thing, that the whistleblower is not accurate, that Congress is overstepping. You saw his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, now a number of times on Twitter and in different interviews suggesting that he, the president, or Rudy Giuliani are going to be filing a lawsuit or pushing back against members of Congress, saying they're overstepping their bounds.
And where does this go if there continues to be an impasse? Does the House have any sort of recourse beyond just ultimately deciding to present the articles of impeachment and vote?
Well, I think before it gets to that point, there's probably going to be a legal battle again. You know, we've seen a lot of those since the beginning of the year where Congress is asking and demanding, subpoenaing different documents and asking people to come testify in front of the committees. And the White House and the administration is pushing back. And so what they've done in the past in these last few months is basically go to court, to take them to court and ask a judge to demand these documents, a judge to demand that these members, or these people that are close to the president testify. And so it's been a legal battle. The problem with the legal battle for Congress is that it takes a long time. It can take months or more just to do the back and forth and go through all that. And I think Adam Schiff earlier today made it very clear they are not looking to do something that's going to take months and months. They are looking at a much quicker recourse. And so, you know, maybe they will go straight to impeachment. They will use what they're calling the obstruction of justice as part of the impeachment process. Maybe that will be an article of impeachment. So we are hearing that they want to move quicker than they have since January. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see some different avenue.
Also, Anita, before I let you go, has there been much response you've been hearing to Bernie Sanders taking a break from the campaign trail as he recovers from double stent insertion in Las Vegas yesterday?
Well, you know, it just happened, and there's been just a lot of speculation by observers, people watching the race and wondering, you know, is he going to say he can't continue on? I doubt that very much would happen. But it will be interesting to see if people are saying to him, you can't continue on. Do you want to take a break or not do this anymore? I think that's not going to happen, but we will see if his support stays with him. You know, someone like Elizabeth Warren would be more likely to get his support than the other front runner, Joe Biden. You know, they're more in tune with each other, Warren and Sanders, more alike on issues. So, I mean, it would be possible that this is something that helps Senator Elizabeth Warren, and she's already, going up in the polls. So this could be something that actually ends up helping her.
Yeah. And as you said, though, it's hard to imagine Bernie Sanders dropping out unless he just absolutely had to. He's got so much energy despite his 78 years of age. He did have to cancel some appearances in the Carolinas because of losing his voice. Now his campaign taking a break indefinitely as he recovers from heart surgery. Thanks so much, Anita. We appreciate your joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for Politico, with us on Air Talk. Coming up momentarily, we'll talk about proposal to tax services, not just goods, with a sales tax in California. We'll hear the pros and cons in a moment. It's It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. The state of California has had an ongoing challenge, and it's a big one. It's that the revenue it collects in taxes is so volatile, so subject to investors' gains at the higher income level, that the state has been trying to figure out a way of evening it out, because it makes it very difficult to budget if you're always dealing with boom years like this one or bust years that you know are coming, but you don't know when. So one of the proposals has been to tax services similarly to the way goods are taxed, so that people who are cutting hair or providing legal services or other things, that they would be paying a certain percentage of a tax for the service that they're provided. One of the proponents of that is California State Senator and Majority Leader Bob Hertzberg. Senator, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
I love being in the studio. Thanks, Larry, for everything you do for the discussion of public policy. We really appreciate it.
Well, this one is one that affects a lot of different industries. We can understand what the upside is, because this would take us away somewhat from the income tax, make a more broader-based sales tax. How would the threshold be set for what that rate of tax would be?
Well, the first question is, just so you know, to give a little bit more dimension to what you just said, Larry, is in 2008, we had the downturn. The actual economy only shrunk by 3%, but the budget of California shrunk by 23%. Furloughs, shutdowns, horrible impact. So that's what informs my thinking. How do you fix the larger problem? And basically, we've been working on this when I was out of government after I left the speakership for nearly 10 years now with Nicholas Berguin and the Berguin Institute and others. And what we've come down to, particularly because of the Trump tax, Trump basically says that you can't deduct business expenses and you can't deduct sales tax anymore. So our plan is between 2 cents and 3 cents of just business to business. So when you suggested haircuts, that doesn't include haircuts. There won't be taxed. Only business to business transactions. And the benefit of that is both, A, it's not deductible under the new Trump tax, so it helps California, and B, so many other people come into California to take advantage of California's environment, and they don't pay anything. This is almost like a hotel tax. They would pay, and it would level the playing field between out-of-state businesses and local businesses.
So give us examples of these business-to-business services that would be taxed.
So let's start with a lawyer. In the case of a lawyer, if, for example, you came and went and said, I want to draft my will, no tax. If you, on the other hand, decided to build an apartment building with a bunch of partners for business purposes and you went to a lawyer to draft the leases and the purchase and sale agreements, there'd be 2 or 3 cents at the end of the bill. So if the bill was $10,000, it'd be $10,200, just like when you go buy an iPhone or something else at the store. It would be displayed below. It wouldn't be incorporated in the price to put pressure on the retailer, and it would be added to it, and it would be a way to, as you suggest, level out and avoid the larger problem. Let me tell you something. It is the last thing I want to deal with in taxes. I hate the subject to the death.
Which is funny, because you've been so associated with versions of this for a long time.
Yeah, but I have for all the right reasons, and that is we have a problem. You know, you can't get in the government and just cherry pick the fun stuff. You got to work on the tough stuff. So we did, you know, rainy day fund in the near term with Governor Schwartz and Schnitzel. We did a 50% plus one. We fixed term limits, initiative reform. This is one of these things on a bipartisan basis. I'm working with folks on all sides of the aisle and hundreds of meetings across the state to try to figure out how to solve this volatility problem when things are good before things get bad.
Do you think your colleagues in the legislature would be willing to pass this, or do you think going to voters directly with a measure is the way to go?
Well, I've been introducing it every year since I've been back in government. Now, as you suggest, I'm the majority leader, but I've been introducing it for discussion purposes only. Gavin Newsom has been really interested. He's been working with us at the Think Long Committee on this issue. He cares deeply about this. He understands the larger framework. We have to modernize California. This is a place where 82% of non-governmental income in California revenue or activity is services. 82%. In the 50s, it was a minor fraction of that. We built a tax structure based upon the wrong stuff. Okay, get a life. It's hard to do. figure it out. Let's fix it before it becomes a new problem.
Would it be easier to sell this to the public if it's going to be an initiative, if in some way there is a tax cut?
Yes.
So the total revenues don't necessarily increase. You're keeping you find some median and you keep that over time for planning, but you're not generally increasing taxes.
Well, that's the question. That's the question. And what I've been doing on for the last nine, almost 10 years, working with a number of experts and folks all across California and actually nationally, is trying to answer the question, how do you modernize the system? At what rate do you tax? What do you do with the money? Do you tax it 3 cents, 5 cents, 2 cents? What does that look like? But the general argument to the public is the following. One, this is an anti-Trump tax. Trump punished California by virtue of his tax reform, and this is a way to level the playing field. Two, it only applies on business-to-business transactions. So if you buy a home, it doesn't affect you. You get a haircut, it doesn't affect you. Even if you have a small business, we've exempted small business under $100,000. You don't have to collect tax. Three, 49 other states of the union have service tax. 49. Only Oregon doesn't have
service
tax.
Are they all business to business?
No, no. In Hawaii, it includes doctors and all and every kind of service there is. I've looked at every tax.
But I would presume in most of those states, they collect less in income tax.
That's exactly right.
That's the counterbalance.
That's the counterbalance. And you go to Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where my uncle was from. He had a house worth $200,000. His property tax was $22,000. Texas, the same kind of example. Here we have low property tax. And we have a higher income tax with a handful of people paying it that creates this extraordinary volatility, which hurts this government. Just like running a business, the idea is let's figure it out and fix it and ask the tough questions. And that's what I'm seeking to do here.
So we have so many smart people that are listening, Senator. I want to open up this to their ideas. So if we agree on the premise that revenue is highly volatile in California and that that's not a good thing,
that's right.
It needs to be evened out in some way. What do you think would be the best way to do it? Do you like this proposed initiative to put a tax 2-3% on business-to-business services as a way of doing it? What other ways do you think it could be done? What do you see as the pros and cons of this proposal from Senator Hertzberg? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. Larry Mantle with California Senator Bob Hertzberg. He's Majority Leader, a former Speaker pro tem, right?
Speaker.
And that was, when was that?
During the energy crisis. I have all the fun times. Yeah. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, all right.
20 years.
We're talking with him about his proposal to raise revenue and to even out the volatility in California's tax collection with a business-to-business services tax. Also joining me from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, President John Kupal. Mr. Kupal, good to have you with us again. First of all, if this ended up being on average revenue neutral, would this be something you could support?
Well, first of all, the devil is in the details. And again, Larry, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. In all the discussions that we've had on this, and by the way, Senate Bill 522, which is the statement of intent for this particular proposal, is just that. It's just a statement of intent without any of the specifics. In all the discussions I've had with folks on the other side of the aisle, including my good friend Bob Hertzberg, he's always indicated that it could not be revenue neutral because labor always wants a tax increase. And in fact, the discussions in Sacramento is that this would be in lieu of the split roll tax, which is an $11 billion tax hike. So if there's been a change in position that this would truly be revenue neutral, I suppose we'd take a look at it, but we would still have a number of concerns. Number one, let's keep in mind that California is still one of the highest tax states in the union, highest income tax rate in America, highest state sales tax rate in America. And I'd like to push back a little bit on the contention that relative to Texas, we're a low property tax state. We rank 17th out of 50 states in per capita property tax collection. So,
because of the values of property here being so high.
That's right. That's right. It's the rate may be low, but the values are so high that when you look at the effective rate, we still remain a high property tax state. So we have a lot of concerns about this. Number one, the notion that you can have a sales tax on businesses versus services tax on businesses versus a services tax on personal. Services that like haircuts and stuff like that. That's a little bit of a smokescreen, because as businesses pay taxes, those taxes filter down to the ultimate consumer. And so I know that John Kabatek is on the line as well, representing small business. But as someone who represents citizen taxpayers, we are concerned with anything that has an impact on the business climate in the state of California. And again, California ranks dead last for 14 years in a row as a place to do business. And there's a reason why businesses are leaving, and that is because of the hostile tax and regulatory climate. I think the last thing we would want to do is give California businesses another reason to pull up stakes and move out of the state of California.
Along the line of what you're saying, John Kupal, Sarah tweets at AirTalk, no, it's costly enough to start a small business in California. Plus, they tax the hell out of us already. No more taxes, at least not on the working class. And Andrea messaged on our AirTalk Facebook page, we don't need new tax revenue sources. How about setting expenditures for the lower revenue levels and during boom years, put some money aside, repay some of the state's debt, and fully fund all of those unfunded pension liabilities? That's Andrea on the AirTalk page. Before I go to John Kabatek, let me go back to Senator Hertzberg. So let's take Andrea's first. She says, okay, you even this out by the state being disciplined enough at banks during the boom years to be able to subsidize the lean years. Why not do that?
Well, that's exactly what we've done. We have billions and billions of dollars in the bank that we did with Governor Schwarzenegger, that I was involved with creating this rainy day fund. And now we have four separate rainy day funds to hold money on education, on social services, on the regular reserve, and the big rainy day fund that we did with Arnold. So that's really good. Two, we have paid down billions and billions both in pension funds and paid off all of the debts that we've had in government. We have done that. So I'm just excited how responsible we've been in that regard. The test here is, and it's hard sometimes to think long about government, but to be able to be prepared and to be responsible and get ahead of the game. So we've done that. And the last thing I just want to say on the business-to-business issue about whether it's a smokescreen or not, it's pretty simple to understand. If you deduct, you pay taxes. If you don't deduct, you don't. And for small businesses, any business under $100,000, we don't even look at you.
That's gross, I assume.
What?
Gross. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. We don't have to do it. And the bottom line is, just like sales tax now and all the other states that collect service tax, we can go online for free and download a program. It's a pretty simple thing to be able to make that happen.
All right. We're talking with State Senator Bob Hertzberg, who's talking about this business-to-business services tax as a way of evening out revenue volatility in California. John Kabatek is director here in California for the National Federation of Independent Business. John, it's good to have you with us again. What would you see the effect being on some of your members?
Well, Larry, thank you very much for having me on. It's great to be on with my friend John Kupal and Senator Hertzberg, both of them good friends, and happy to be here to represent our 16,000 small businesses across the state. Well, first of all, again, as Kupal had said, you know, devil is in the details. But and I do appreciate Senator Hertzberg wanting to address tax reform and modernization in our state. Nothing is more concerning to Californians right now than the high cost of living. But real tax reform really has to begin, Larry, with reining in existing onerous taxes in California, not loading new ones on already uncertain small businesses and, frankly, families, especially when our state coffers are $20 billion in the black. John Kupal mentioned, of course, we have the highest statewide sales tax, income tax, regulations, all of them hitting Main Street businesses the most. A sales tax on services of any kind really does nothing to address our state's budget volatility. Four of the more recent analyses of the more recent sales tax on services have shown that they would actually have done very little to address our volatility, maybe 20%. So it really doesn't fix that. But more importantly, it picks on small businesses, most of whom deal with accountants, legal help, IT professionals, and others. And many of them actually will feel the pain of this when it comes to services tax. So as these costs go up, they'll be passed on to consumers. And at the end of the day, we've also found that even just a 5% sales tax on services will cost Californians about $16,000 for the cost of a new home, about $17 million for the construction cost of a school, and our roads and highways costs would increase by 3.2%. How are young families expected to really, any Californian, but especially our young families, expected to afford that on top of our already very, very high costs?
So even if it's only business to business, John, you're still arguing that would get passed through to the home buyer.
Absolutely. And small business owners, think about that when you're talking about business to business, when you're talking about vendors and others who have to deal with this. Those costs are passed on directly to the consumers. And listen, Larry, what we hear from our small business owners at NFIB is they don't mind paying the right taxes, dealing with the right regulations. But right now, again, our coffers are bursting. Frankly, right now, they also don't have any trust that leaders are spending the money, the gas tax money, our sales and income tax dollars from years ago that are being spent responsibly. So, I think we're finding, how can we fault a mom and pop out there who's trying to achieve the California dream
okay.
when they don't know where the current money is going? And frankly, when we already have a bank account that is $20 billion with a B in the black.
John, hold that thought. Senator Hertzberg, your response to that?
Yeah, first of all, Brian, I think your brother is a great guy. But in any event, I have an optimistic view of life, and that is God's in the details, not devil's in the details. And we've been focusing, talking to every group in every corner of the state, and the arguments that you make are arguments that were made 5 years ago. We've been listening to folks around the state, listening to the frustrations that small business has and the like. That's why we've exempted them. We've listened to the frustrations that homeowners have and the high cost of housing. That's why we exempted them. So I read this report that came out the other day and talked about this stuff, and my response was, you're fighting World War I. Certainly this kind of broad idea of just saying we hate tax, that's why I hate getting involved, because as soon as you mention the word, you're already marked. But the truth of the matter is, it's exactly what you said, and that is the right tax. That's what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to get to the right tax so we do not have these downturns and these ridiculous furloughs and other things that happen, that we can pay for education, the kinds of things we need to do with the state, and avoiding what has been our history.
Let's talk with Mike in Anaheim. I understand you're a consultant for cities and counties. How would you see a tax like this playing out?
I think with any sort of tax on businesses, you really need to keep in mind that most of it will go to consumers. The business, the corporation itself, doesn't really exist. You have shareholders, you have people who work for the business, and you have the people who consume what that business sells. And just because of the way that the economics work out, the people who are going to get hurt the most are the consumers and the people who work for the business. I think there's this idea that, these evil corporations, and they make so much money and we need to tax them, but you have to realize that the tax revenue is not really coming from the people who own the business most of the time. There are some exceptions, but, not every business, it's going to shake out the same, but they're going to make every effort to pass those costs on. That's just kind of the way that business taxes work.
All right, Mike, I appreciate your call. Let me share some listener comments that are coming in on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Rob writes on the page, sales tax in this state should be revamped to cover all or most transactions. It's frustrating for a business deemed a manufacturer has to charge more than 8%, whereas a dry cleaner collects none. Let's lower the sales tax to 4%, exempt food and medicine. Property tax needs to be done as well. Disneyland shouldn't be paying 5 cents on its square foot versus the new business paying 50 cents a square foot. It's unfair. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Real quickly, Senator Hertzberg, in closing, what's the next step here for this?
Well, I just want to address Mike's point about passing on to the consumers. He's right. He's 100% correct. And so what our plan has done is we call what's called the tax incidence, and any dollars that are directed, we're basically rebating back to people so that the system remains equally progressive. Very difficult into the details, but very important. Second, the real essence of this is the federal government stuck it to California by saying you can't deduct your state taxes anymore. And what we're doing here, in the essence of what we're doing, is two things. One, telling the federal government, you got to pick up your fair share because we're paying a lot of money of expenses we're not paying for there. And secondly, outside businesses that come to California have got to pay their fair share. And there's no local add-ons for local tax. It's a state number. There will be a constitutionally permissive element that says local government, so it won't go above the 2-3% without a vote of the people. We got to get it right. We got to modernize California. It's a tough discussion. Now's the time to have it, rather than at a time when things are falling apart.
State Senator Bob Hertzberg joining us. He's the Senate Majority Leader. Good to have you with us again.
Hey, it's wonderful to be here, Larry. Thank you for doing this.
And my thanks to John Kupal, frequently joins us on Air Talks, the president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, as does John Kabatek, who's California Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I recall when I was away a few weeks ago, there was a segment about people pining for particular dishes, baked goods that were no longer available because the restaurant was gone. And so there are people who attempt to recreate this, often in their home kitchens, and even professionals do this. Elena Shatkin, the food editor at LAist.com, actually made a project out of this. And Elena, just for those who missed that segment, which includes me because I was away.
That's so right. Kyle was hosting.
Yeah, Kyle was hosting that day. So what was this project about?
So I collaborated with Valerie Gordon, who is here sitting next to me, of the fabulous Valerie Confections, which, by the way, makes one of my very favorite cakes in the city, the Blum's Coffee Crunch Cake, which is amazing. And we had talked about, like, wouldn't it be cool to revive a fantastic, classic, old school Los Angeles dessert for LAist? And Valerie was all in on it. And, you know, so we...
You took suggestions from people?
We called, you know, we put a call out to the Hive Mind, to our, you know, KPCC and LAist audience, and asked, what dessert would you love to see Valerie revive? Because she's kind of a food ethnographer known for reviving some old-timey desserts and cakes, well, including the Blum's Coffee Crunch Cake.
Including the Blum's and things from the Brown Derby, from Chasen. So I've resurrected over 10 desserts over the past decade, but they've all been desserts that I've sort of looked into on my own. We've never put it out to the wild.
Okay.
So this is pretty exciting.
Yeah. So what, which dish, which baked goods, Valerie, is going to be recreated?
Well, the dish she chose is the strawberry cream cake from Clifton's. It's a delicious combo of sponge and cream and berries, but she should tell you why she chose it.
Yeah, why?
So we got so many very emotional submissions, which is really amazing. And I read through all of them, probably 3 or 4 times. And the one from Clifton's really stood out for a number of reasons. A, it's so sad they closed. And they closed not that long ago. B, there's
although
something
they may reopen.
They may reopen. Yeah. So we'll find out. We'll find out. And they do have the bar open.
Yeah.
Right? But they don't have the bakery portion open. They're not manufacturing those things right now. And there's something just incredibly fantastical about Clifton's and the lore of the Clifton's cafeteria. And I think one of the aspects that I really get into with these resurrections is that feeling of fantasy around dessert and resurrecting those incredible sense memories that people have. And then I did a bit of a Google search on this particular dessert, and it is an amazing dessert. It's really, it looks luscious and gooey, and it's colorful, and it's big and kind of fluffy. And it's just, it's a very happy looking cake. It's very happy looking. And one of the barometers that I always have within these dessert resurrections is, could this have touched a large swath of people? But a lot of people remember this dessert and really yearn for it. So that's really a big thing. Was this dessert offered to many generations, or was it just available for 1 or 2 years?
Yeah.
Clifton's has all of it.
And Clifton's, being downtown Los Angeles,
yes,
and a large dining room, so many people came through Clifton's over the years. We're talking with Valerie Gordon, who's food historian, chocolatier, and owner of Valerie Confections, an artisan confectionery and bakery in Silver Lake. Elena Shatkin, LAist and KPCC food editor. I'd love to hear from you. If you had a particular success trying to recreate something, and it doesn't have to be something that's a baked good or dessert, it could be an entree from somewhere, what was your experience trying to recreate it? And if you were able to do it, was there a particular missing piece that enabled you to cross the line and to get that? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. My wife and I tried to recreate the Chasen's chili,
oh,
and we're not able to do it, but we came pretty close with the El Tovar chili from the historic hotel at the Grand Canyon, who has an incredible chili. If you like chili, El Tovar. We pretty much nailed El Tovar. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. What fond dish do you have a memory of? Maybe it's something that's even available, but you want to do it on your own. Share with us, what was the hurdle you overcame to be able to do it? 866-893-KPECC. And if there's some that you're just stuck on, put it out there. Maybe someone else has an answer to your question. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. So, Elena, what did people say about the Clifton strawberry cake?
Well, the woman who nominated it, her name is Monica Melgoza, and she writes, "My mom is an immigrant from Mexico. The first cake she ever had was this cake, and to her, it means America. She tells us the story all the time, and it's a long story." So we hope to talk to Monica soon and get more details about it, and she will maybe, hopefully, be one of our testers.
I was going to say, you got to bring her in to see if it's authentic, right?
Absolutely.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes on the page, "My all-time favorite was the bread pudding and with chantilly cream sauce from the Velvet Turtle." Remember the chain of Velvet Turtles here in Southern Cal? There was one, in fact, within walking distance, just down the street here from KPECC, like a 5-minute walk.
I feel like I still see one out in Palm Springs or somewhere in that area.
That's Wally's Desert Turtle, I believe it's called, but it was from the same...
It's a different upscale turtle.
It's okay. Only one left, but it's not part of the same chain as the Velvet Turtle. There was one in Chinatown, which they just tore down not long ago. It had been vacant for many years. And the one here in Pasadena, they tore down and built Houston's restaurant on Arroyo Parkway. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a particular dish, and it could be an entree, a dessert that was offered at a restaurant that's long gone. And maybe you've tried to recreate it and you've had success. You had to solve a certain problem. Love to quickly hear about that. Or if you got a hurdle on recreating something, love to hear about what that is. Let's talk with Uli in downtown Los Angeles. What did you try and recreate and from where?
Hi, Larry. My name is Uli, and I am actually a recipe maker owner at a gelato store here in downtown L.A.
Great.
Gelateria Uli.
Hi. I love your gelato, by the way. Sorry, I had to say that.
Oh, as do I. It's incredible. Lovely to make your acquaintance.
Same here. I heard you on here. I love her. I go to your store all the time. I go far downtown everywhere. I was actually very intrigued when one day I read that founding fathers really loved oyster ice cream.
Wow.
I decided I have to make it. I love oysters. To me, they're more of a, I would say, dessert delicacy. And I said, listen, that would be interesting. It's kind of like frozen oyster chowder. Let's see what would happen. So I actually had a friend who at the time worked at a oyster farm in Rhode Island, and I contacted him and I said, send me some oysters, but help me because I need to find the right taste profile. So he sent me something that wasn't too briny, was on the sweeter side, beautiful oysters. I think they were from like late summer because...
How did they, Lily, I need to just hustle you along a little bit here. So how did it turn out?
It turned out great. We gave it away for free. We didn't charge for it. And we actually, you know, it's one of those things when you put yourself out there, people would be like, this is disgusting. People loved it. People absolutely loved it.
Was it sweet or savory?
Both. It was kind of like, you know how when you have chowder, there's a lot of cream in it.
So yeah.
Sweetness, sweetness, but it's also a little salty. So it was both. It was great. And it wasn't. It wasn't as terrible as it sounds. I love
oysters. I'm not sure about oyster ice cream, but Uli, thanks very much. But
I have to try that.
If you're as gifted, what do you call someone who runs a gelato shop? A
gelateria?
Gelateria. Yeah, I was trying to think of what
gelatus?
The right... We'll throw an A on the end of the word. Uli, thanks so much. 866-893-KPCC or the gelateria. Wynn in Whittier says, my favorite dish is the fried mozzarella at Mario's in Westwood. Boy, talk about a restaurant. Been around a long time. It was creamy, melty, so delicious. Mario's is gone after a very long run, but that melted... cheese dish, a favorite. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, KPCC. Stephen Whittier misses the Vickman strawberry pie. Oh, that was good. A lost baked good.
I've never even heard of Vickman's.
Can we get details on this?
Man. Vickman's
details.
Was right across the street, as I recall, from the produce market downtown Los Angeles.
Okay.
So they're open for breakfast in the morning. They were in their heyday. And it was a terrific place. And foodies would come. You have to get there early.
Okay.
So, but it's as downtown was bustling around the produce market. But
what made that strawberry pie special?
I can't tell you. I think one of the things was it didn't get soggy.
Okay.
It held multiple textures, which is a challenge with anything with strawberries, of course. It can get soggy and it loses the integrity of the different ingredients.
Right. Yeah, the structural integrity can really collapse.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You don't want it like a strawberry thing. You don't want it sitting around because it'll be a goner. Vickman's was somehow able to keep that. Steve, thanks very much. 866-893-KPCC. Rosemary says, one of my favorites was the Brown Derby's grapefruit cake.
We do that.
Which Valerie resurrected. And also, I can account for the fact it's delicious.
Come get it. It's here for you. ValerieConfections.com.
So how challenging was it to recreate that?
That was a hard recipe to recreate.
What was the challenge?
One of the challenges to that recipe was the difference in ingredients that were available in the origin recipe and ingredients that we use today. So things like cream cheese, I think, had a very different texture 40 or 50 years ago. And they called for things like it was a specific ingredient, which I took a liberty with. There was canned grapefruit and syrup that was used both in the frosting and within the cake. And the result was something that was incredibly wet and not visually exciting. So I shifted that and changed it to fresh grapefruit from the farmer's market using zest instead of canned grapefruit in syrup.
To get that intensity.
To get the same intensity of flavor, but a slightly different look. But everybody says that it tastes like the cake, which is great.
Which, given you're doing something as different as fresh instead of canned, that's impressive because you might think some of the sweetness would be lost.
Right. It took that cake took probably 15 tests to get it to a place where it felt correct and honoring the origin recipe.
How many versions do you think it might take to do the Clifton strawberry cake? I got to know. Just take me,
probably
give me a guess.
Probably 10.
Okay.
It generally takes about 10 tries. And I start off by looking at different recipes of the same era. I'll talk to people and try to get Larry Mantle. I think that you would be such a great asset in exploring a historic dessert because I have a feeling that you could describe a cake so specifically, and you could talk texture, you could talk height, you could talk
the way the fork goes. I will make that sacrifice to offer my services as you develop it.
I volunteer as tribute to be a taster.
Thank you.
let's talk with Pamela in Burbank. Pamela, what have you tried to make?
I tried to make Griswold's brand muffins.
Yeah, Griswold's brand muffins. And what seems to be the barrier to getting the taste right?
Well, I've tried probably 7 or 8 different recipes and then tried to tweak those to get it to be the same. They were incredibly moist and had a good sticky quality and were just sort of melt in your mouth.
And they were, I remember they looked perfect. They just had that. And how many did they make? Because that was a huge, and they had more than one, but those were huge restaurants.
Yes.
So they had to make a lot of them. So you've tried 7 or 8 times. Have you given up? Or are you going to go back to the kitchen on it?
Well, every once in a while I think, okay, it's time to try again.
What is failing in your perspective, texturally or visually?
Well, many of them come out dry or too soupy. Like theirs had like a glaze on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the texture was perfect and they weren't too sweet. Some go too sweet. Sometimes the raisins overpower it. Sometimes they're super dry. It's sort of like when you try something that's kind of from an organic health food perspective.
All right. Pamela, I appreciate it. You have a quick recommendation to her?
From the get-go, it sounds like your temperature of your oven might be an issue. I would have the gas company come and make sure that your oven is actually reading correctly.
I didn't know gas company did that.
They do that, and they do it for free.
Really? Wow.
If you call them, and they'll come and check it out and stick their little thingies in there and let you know, is it real or are you 50 degrees off?
Elaine in Glendora says, I've recreated the recipe of the Brown Derby's barbecue sauce.
Wow.
It was my neighbor's mother's recipe and she nailed it. She took a sample of the Brown Derby, had the chef there sample it. He was not pleased by its accuracy.
Amazing.
Ray has taken back to my childhood the English trifle at Gulliver's, late of Marina Del Rey. They were another small chain, Gulliver's, with their prime rib centric restaurant. Yeah, that was a great trifle. And Tad in Redondo Beach says, it's a tradition in the fire service. If you work overtime, you bring in a dessert. We spent years trying to reproduce Famous Amos chocolate chip cookies and finally came close. Tad, thanks so much. Thank you, Valerie, for joining us. We'll look forward to your experiments as you create the Clifton Strawberry Cake. Valerie Gordon of Valerie Confections in Silver Lake and Elena Chatkin, thanks for having you with us. We'll look forward to the successful execution of this.
So will I. Thank you.
All right. From all of us at Air Talk, have a terrific afternoon.